November 15th marks the 53rd anniversary of the Clutter murders in Holcomb, Kansas. Truman Capote's investigation of the murders resulted in one of the best-selling nonfiction crime novels of all time. So what can Capote tell us about Kansas? KU professor Dave Tell has done extensive research on Capote's time in Kansas, revealing both Capote's views of our state and how Kansans perceive their own identity in the wake of the quadruple murders. Dave Tell is a professor in the Department of Communication Studies over at KU, and so good to have you here, Dave. Thanks for coming over.
My pleasure.
Well, for those who don't know what happened back on that night of November 14th, 1959 in Holcomb, Kansas, tell us, remind us what happened.
Well, on November 14th, 1959, two former convicts, both on parole from the Kansas State Penitentiary in Lansing, Kansas, drove the width of the state until they arrived at the Clutter Farmstead in Holcomb, Kansas. Now, Holcomb is in the southwest corner of the state. It's about 5 miles west of Garden City. And the two ex-convicts, Perry Smith and Dick Hickok, were there on a tip from a former fellow jailmate, named Floyd Wells. Wells had given them to believe that in the basement of the farmhouse, they would find a safe with upwards of thousands of dollars, out of which the Clutters paid the itinerant farmhands that did the work. Now, when they got in the house, they quickly learned that there was no safe.
But
from the start, they were committed to a perfect murder, or a perfect crime, rather. The perfect crime required no witnesses, and no witnesses required the elimination of everyone in the house. So in a very methodical manner, they murdered both Herbert Clutter, his wife Bonnie, and the two children who were living in the house at the time. Now, here's the crazy thing. There are two things that the murderers could not possibly have known on November 14th, 1959. Or at least there's no evidence that they knew. Okay, the first is this. Herb Clutter, who to their mind was nothing more than a farmer with a safe in his basement, was actually a nationally renowned figure. He served alongside Ezra Taft Benson in the Eisenhower administration, and throughout the course of the 1950s appeared, if not regularly, at least intermittently in the New York Times as an authority on the so-called farm problem. He was also one of the most widely respected men in the southwest corner of Kansas. Now, this had a number of consequences. It meant, first of all, that the local authorities would leave no stone unturned in their pursuit of justice. More interesting from my perspective is this, and this is the second thing they couldn't have known. Because Clutter was a national figure, his murder was covered 2 days later in the New York Times. At the time, a writer for the New Yorker was looking for a beat. His name was Truman Capote, as you all know.
I was just going to ask you how he learned about the murders, and here we go.
He was reading page 16 of Monday's New York Times on November 16th, and buried on the 16th page, he found three sentences, one short paragraph dedicated to the murder. It captivated him. I mean, the truth was he was looking for a story. This seemed as good as any. He wrote in a letter that Kansas seemed an exotic and foreign place, and he wanted to sort of do something that would challenge him. And it only took him 1 month, in fact, 1 month to the day from his reading in the New York Times on November 16th about the murder. He showed up on December 16th in Garden City, Kansas, with his childhood friend Harper Lee to begin the process of researching and writing his novel.
Harper Lee, who would go on to write To Kill a Mockingbird.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, you wonder, you know, as you look at all this, Dave, you know, here's Capote living in New York City. He's well known, rubbing elbows with all kinds of celebrities. There's plenty of crime in New York City. What was it about the Clutter case that drew him halfway across the continent?
I mean, like I mentioned, part of it was purely sort of an exoticism. Kansas was a place he never knew.
It was a foreign country to him.
And I think that sort of the cultural clash between the cosmopolitan, openly gay Truman Capote, now going by train and then by car all the way to the southwest corner of Kansas, a very traditional space if there ever was one. I think that that sort of cultural clash has been well played, but I think it misses one very important thing. That for all the tension between the cosmopolitan Capote and the traditional Kansas, it took him virtually no time before he had good friends. So remember, he got to Holcomb on December 16th. His big breakthrough came 8 days later, only 8 days. On December 24th, he got an invitation to have Christmas Eve dinner with State Senator Clifford Hope and his family. And at that party was the KBI agent, Alvin Dewey, and his family, who would eventually become dear, dear friends to Capote, who Capote would fly around the country, who would keep not quite a daily correspondence for 6 years, but several times weekly, the Deweys and Capote would correspond. So while there is truth to the tension between Southwest Kansas and the cosmopolitan Capote, what I was surprised to learn is the depth of the friendship.
It sort of worked out for him, didn't it? Through a series of just, what, luck and happenstance, I guess, to some degree here.
Luck and happenstance, and Harper Lee was a big part of his luck in that first week.
Because she, what did she do for him?
Well, she, if Capote was coming from Manhattan, Harper Lee was coming from a small southern rural town. And she understood and could empathize with the people of Southwest Kansas, and they could recognize her as one of their own. And so she was important initially in sort of helping Truman Capote build those bridges.
What did Truman Capote think of Holcomb, Kansas? What did he and Harper Lee, what sort of ideas were going through their heads as they were, you know, in visiting for the first time and spending time in Holcomb?
It is really hard to know. The famous first paragraph of the book describes Holcomb as sort of a backwater, wide spot in the road. And the fame and the sort of quotations of that first paragraph have contributed to a widespread perception that he did not like Kansas. But I can't say he did like it, but he was certainly enamored with it. He physically wrote most of the book from Europe. First at a beach house in Spain, and then secondly from a mountain chalet in Switzerland.
And did he actually write it, or did Harper Lee write it? Because there's still this sort of ongoing talk about that whole issue.
I think he wrote it, and the reason I think that is this. When he and Harper Lee showed up on December 16th, they stayed there for only a month. By January 20th, they were both back in New York City, and within weeks, Truman Capote was in Europe and Harper Lee was back in the South. And then a shocking thing happens, that Truman Capote loses track of Harper Lee. And in fact, in 1962 and 1963, he's writing letters back to the KBI agent Alvin Dewey saying, "Have you heard from Nell?" That was his nickname for Harper Lee.
Huh.
"I've lost her. I'm concerned about her." And of course, at this point, To Kill a Mockingbird is out, and Harper Lee famously becomes very quiet and reserved. But Truman Capote is no exception. He almost completely left. By the time the book came out in 65 in The New Yorker and 66 as a Random House novel, he had almost completely lost track of her.
That's interesting. So he took 6 years to write this book. Why did it take him so long?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
He had most of it done by late 1961 at the latest, if perhaps at the latest early 1962.
Mm-hmm.
But the execution of Perry Smith and Dick Hickok wouldn't come till April of 1965. And Capote was convinced that his book he was convinced that he was writing a masterpiece. As early as 1961, he would write home saying, "This is going to be the best thing I've ever written. This is going to make..." And of course, it did make his career.
Yeah.
But he was also equally convinced that it needed the resolution of the execution. And that wouldn't come for years. And the appeals process, it gave Truman Capote great anxiety. In fact, he even wrote letters back to Kansas trying to keep track of various political elections in the state, because he knew if the wrong person got elected, that could put into jeopardy the fact that Smith and Hickok would get executed. And that could put into jeopardy the perfect ending to his book.
Which he was desperate to see.
Which he was desperate. And this is, this is a very complicated relationship between the murderers and Capote. It's a very instrumental relationship on both sides. There's been a lot of stories and a lot of rumors about a very intimate and close relationship between particularly Perry Smith and Truman Capote. And that's true. There are some very intimate moments between them where they do seem like they're vulnerable and they're sharing personal things. But on the other hand, it's instrumental both ways. Perry Smith never forgets that Truman Capote is his best advocate. And Truman Capote never forgets that Perry Smith is his best ticket to a best-selling novel.
Hmm.
And so even after their execution is a sure thing, about 2 weeks before the execution, Truman Capote writes back and says he's decided not to attend because it's not necessary from what he calls, quote, a literary perspective. And that sort of put in perspective whatever intimacy we might want to see between the murderers and Truman Capote. From his perspective, he needed them for his novel. And I'm tempted to read whatever gestures of intimacy we might see there as little more, perhaps a little bit more, but not much more than a play in order to help the murderers feel closer to him, disclose more to him, give him the firsthand story he needs.
We're visiting with KU professor Dave Tell. He's a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at KU about Truman Capote's classic In Cold Blood and what it can tell us about Kansas. Tell us a little more about Perry Smith and Dick Hickok. Describe them to us. What kind of guys were they, Dave?
Well, it depends who's asking, Steve. I mean, it really does.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that struck me as I was reading the various Kansas reactions to Truman Capote and In Cold Blood is that no one could simply agree on who these people were. In fact, when you look at how In Cold Blood played in the southwest corner of the state, if you look at the reviews that appeared following the serialization in The New Yorker, and if you look at the coverage of Truman Capote's visits, what you're going to find is this. There was one overall objection to Capote's coverage of the murder, and that is that he treated the murderers, Perry Smith and Dick Hickok, primarily as psychological subjects.
Hmm.
And in fact, this was no accident. The strongest outpost of psychology in Kansas at the time was the Menninger Psychiatric Clinic.
I was going to ask you. Mm-hmm.
In Topeka. At the time, Carl Menninger and his associate Joseph Satin were doing a number of research projects on what they called murder without apparent motive. That is, these strange murders that you can't figure out why it happened. And in fact, they had traveled to Philadelphia, given a talk on the subject, and then flown directly back to Kansas, driven out to Garden City, and Joseph Satin and Carl Menninger had psychoanalyzed Perry Smith and Dick Hickok.
Which is perfect for Truman Capote's purposes.
It is. In fact, so perfect that immediately after Joseph Satin of Menninger leaves Garden City, he takes a vacation to London. Capote gets word of this, travels from his house in Spain to London, and they spend 3 days in London's Cumberland Hotel talking nothing but psychology and murder. This three-day conversation was as influential in the writing of In Cold Blood as any conversation Capote ever had in Kansas. If you look at the final and climactic fourth section of the novel, and you read it again through with Menninger sitting in the back of your head, here's what you're going to see. You're going to see psychological terms, psychological explanations. And in fact, at one point in the novel, Capote goes so far as to cite an article in an academic psychological journal authored by Joseph Satin as an explanation for what happened, as an explanation more particularly of who Perry Smith and Dick Hickok were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And here's why Southwest Kansas didn't like it. If you psychologize Perry Smith and Dick Hickok, you might be tempted to think that the murder was not so much their fault, that they were victims of a society that had mistreated them. Okay, one of the things that both Menninger and Satin were into was taking a murderer and looking back at his or her early childhood and finding what happened early in that childhood that could possibly explain what they did later in life. The Dodge City Daily Globe made this explicit. They said, if we psychologize these murders, if we turn them into psychological subjects, here's what could happen. It could turn into a great case of murder, that is, the state of Kansas murdering two unfortunate victims of society. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the debate became, and this goes directly to your question, who were these murderers, Perry Smith and Dick Hickok? Well, from Capote's perspective, they were psychological subjects. They were victims. From the cities of central Kansas, this was acclaimed. Actually, the Emporia Gazette in particular praised Capote's psychologization of the murderers.
Hmm.
But from the southwest corner of Kansas, those who knew the Clutters personally,
they didn't want to hear that.
Simply intolerable. They saw that as a mechanism to help excuse the murderers and help them escape.
So in Kansas back in those days in the early 60s, this became a deal, a big issue in the state.
It was an issue. But sometimes it's hard to see it as an issue. Mm-hmm. And here's why. I think we have a history. If we want to learn about Capote, we follow the news coverage of the murder, the trial, and the execution. But it's hard to learn about the state of Kansas that way because the murder, the trial, and the execution were all covered by the AP, the Associated Press. And because of that, the same stories appeared in every town under similar headlines.
Yeah.
Now, Truman Capote's visits, reviews of The New Yorker, and reviews of In Cold Blood were not covered by the AP. That means that you can read dramatically different stories if you're reading the Garden City Telegram or the Emporia Gazette mm-hmm. or the Topeka Capital Journal, and you can get a sense, really, that it was an issue.
Yeah. Dave Tell is our guest. He's a KU Communication Studies professor. If you want to join our conversation with your questions about In Cold Blood and its impact on Kansas and what that book tells us about Kansas, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So how did Kansas react to this novel when it came out? Going even beyond how people felt about Perry Smith and Richard Hickok, how did people react to the novel in general and how Kansas was portrayed, Dave?
Great question. And again, it's going to depend on who you ask and where they are. And I think this will surprise nobody, but the first thing that the papers of Dodge City, Liberal, and Garden City did was publish a series of reviews of the then serial, what would eventually become a novel, which was sort of a blow-by-blow account of Capote's telling of the story mm-hmm. that they would then compare to firsthand accounts of the story from people who had lived there. And I think that's a natural. If you've lived through an event, it's quite natural to compare your remembrances to what someone else did.
Did they think he was accurate in what he came out with?
You know, it was about 50-50.
Yeah.
There was people, locals, who said, you know what? He got us right. He nailed us. And there was other people who objected. There was far more unanimity on the question of who these killers were. Were they mm-hmm. psychological subjects? Were they simply murderers?
Yeah.
Now, one thing the reaction to the novel gets a little bit more complex if you move east about 200 miles to the central Kansas cities of Emporia and Hutchinson.
Mm-hmm.
There, Capote was not so much a writer and a researcher like he was in southwestern Kansas. In southwestern Kansas, first and foremost, a writer and a researcher, and therefore he's judged by his fidelity to the facts. If he got them right, he's good. If he didn't, he's bad.
Yeah.
In Emporia and in Hutchinson and in Topeka, he's not so much a writer and a researcher as he is a celebrity, okay? And in fact, Capote got far more coverage when he was on tour with Life magazine or when Hollywood producer Richard Brooks came through. Those were the moments that captivated central Kansas much more so than Capote, the author, the murder writer, or the murder.
Well, that's really interesting. You just were taken with a guy, it sounds like.
They were. And one particularly telling moment is in November of 1965. In that month, Life magazine was getting ready to run a 21-page spread that would announce the publication of the Random House novel. And as part of that spread, they sent a whole team of people out to Kansas, who then toured through the state.
Wow.
Including the international celebrity photographer.
I was going to ask you, Richard Avedon.
That's the one.
Mm-hmm.
Emporia, Hutchinson, Topeka, they were taken with Richard Avedon. In fact, there's a famous picture that I believe is up on your website right now
mm-hmm.
of Truman Capote and Richard Avedon walking down the main street of Garden City, Kansas. And this was the news. The news was that Avedon was here. The news was the cocktail parties, the name dropping, the celebrity, the Hollywood visit from Richard Brooks that was coming up the next year.
Mm.
Here's what's crazy. The Emporia Gazette ran an entire section of the paper devoted to this tour of Kansas. The Dodge City Daily Globe ignored it. Liberal ignored it. The Garden City Telegram didn't quite ignore it, but all they could bring themselves to talk about was the psychologization of the murderers, and they would just simply not ignore. In fact, the name Richard Avedon never appears except in a caption of a photo in the Garden City Telegram.
Well, you would think that there'd be a lot of folks out in the southwestern part of the state just outraged that celebrities are sort of, you know, grabbing the limelight and sort of stealing the thunder away from what is just an incredibly tragic event of a very important person who was once in their midst.
I mean, I think what you just said captures perfectly the conceit of Bill Brown. Mm-hmm. Bill Brown was the editor of the Garden City Telegram. He was incredibly vocal on Truman Capote, and he was probably Truman Capote's most public antagonist. And when, on January 6th of 1966, when Life ran its 21-page spread, there was Bill Brown again on the front page saying, "What have we done? We've turned these folks into celebrities. This is our neighbor who was murdered. There's no need for a 21-page spread in Life magazine."
Let's go to some phone calls here. Mara from Lenexa. Mara, you're on with Dave Tell, KU professor in the Department of Communication Studies. Good morning.
Thank you very much. A very interesting program.
Thank you.
I lived in Garden City for many years, and my parents were acquaintances with the Clutters. But I'm in the next generation, but I knew the Hopes and the Deweys very, very well. And I think the quick relationship that was established by Truman with Marie Dewey in particular was aided by the fact that Marie Dewey was herself a Southern belle, so to speak. I think that she related to Harper Lee and to Truman partly based on their Southern roots.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that goes to the point I talked about earlier of how important Harper Lee was in that first 8 days. What I'd add is how quickly Truman Capote ceased to need connections such as Harper Lee or a Southern background, that when he was writing from Europe to the Deweys, both to Alvin and Marie, they would be very dear letters, talking about how much Kansas was on his mind, how much he – there's one letter in particular that he writes to Marie Dewey where he says how beautiful Kansas must look at this time of year, right? And so if originally there was a incidental connections,
right,
such as being Southern belles, were important, they really did establish a deep friendship that went way beyond those sort of incidental.
Mara, thank you. Where are all those papers, Truman Capote's letters? Where do you find that stuff?
Good question. A lot of them have been published. There's a big, thick book.
Somewhere.
The name of the author is escaping me at the moment, but a vast majority of them have been published, and a lot of them haven't as well. And those that haven't are in the New York Public Library in Manhattan.
Just real quickly before you go, Dave, In Cold Blood is often pegged as one of the great nonfiction crime novels ever written. Does it warrant that description in your view?
You know what? I'm going to go out and say that it does warrant that description.
Yeah.
And I hope that will make people read it. And here's why. If you haven't read it before, In Cold Blood is a great primer on the type of work that's being published today. Think of all the memoirs that are coming out.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Think of all like the James Frey sorts of stuff. All these books that push the boundary of nonfiction and novel.
Dave, I enjoyed having you. Thanks for coming in today.
Cool. Thank you.
That's Professor Dave Tell. You can find photos of Truman Capote and more information about our broadcast at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll dive into the middle school world with the author of Diary of a Wimpy Kid and check in with singer Roseanne Cash. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.